Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Obama economic policy in the hot seat this week. Markets surge. Mr. Madoff goes to jail and new bombings hit Iraq. President Obama answered complaints he's bitten off too much.
I'm not choosing to address these additional challenges just because I feel like it or because I'm a glutton for punishment. I'm doing so because they're fundamental to our economic growth.
Bernard Madoff was out of his penthouse and into the slammer. Maybe for life, victims still felt the pain.
So he goes to jail. He's going to spend the rest of his life in jail. Is that justice? People's lives are ruined. How do you get that back? You just can't get back. You can't get back 40 years of work out the window.
And an Iraqi man cries out after a suicide bomber killed 33 in Baghdad. This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Is the Obama team going too fast, too slow, just right on the economy? Are you happy now that Bernie Madoff is in a 7x8 cell? Should somebody from the SEC be in there with him? With me in the studio today to look at all the news, Jonathan Kaufman, political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Jonathan, great to have you here.
Thanks very much, Tom.
From Washington, we're joined by Andrea Seabrook, congressional correspondent for National Public Radio. Andrea, great to have you as well.
Glad to be here, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Jonathan, and Andrea.
All right, Jonathan, let's go straight to it. The criticism has been hot and heavy this week, even as the stock market went up and up and up after those terrible downs of early in the week and last week. How do you see the debate over how the Obama administration is doing with this terrible economy?
Well, I think one of the signs you can see that they're starting to get worried about the reaction they're getting is that today Larry Summers is being rolled out to give a big speech about the economy.
Not Tim Geithner.
Not Tim Geithner. Tim Geithner, I think, is, you know, a very smart guy, but clearly has not projected the gravitas and the energy to convince people that things are under control. So they're now going to Plan B, which is Larry Summers, who is extremely smart, very well respected, very persuasive. And I think you may start seeing a situation where Summers becomes the public face of the administration, and that Obama himself may have to start addressing this more directly. You know, in the same way we had a kind of a race speech that Obama gave during the campaign that changed the dynamic, it may be time soon for him to give a banking speech that convinces people that he really has a grasp on what needs to be done and can FDR-like restore people's confidence.
And yet, is it a speech or is it a plan, Andrea, that people are waiting for, getting impatient about on Capitol Hill?
Well, you know, one of the interesting points yesterday, somebody made a joke actually in the committee that Geithner was before yesterday.
And saying, boy, did they grill him.
Yeah, they sure did. They asked some really tough questions of him, and it's getting tougher all the time. And someone made the joke that, the Dow is up 100 points, you know, which is unusual when you speak, Mr. Geithner, basically saying that, you know, every time this man speaks, it seems like the markets tank. And so I think that's, you know, not that you can watch the markets every day, but people do anyway, and especially here on Capitol Hill, and everybody's sort of trying to gauge whether this is working or not, whether what the administration is doing is making things better or worse, whether it's an optimism game or not. And, you know, I think rolling out Jonathan's exactly right, rolling out the other guy is probably a smart strategy at this point.
Jack Beattie, the FDR comparison is coming back to bite a little bit here. Michael Hirsch, writing in Newsweek online in the last couple of days, reminds us when FDR came into office, now granted, things were at rock bottom when he came in, but in his first 100 days, FDR's presidency, the stock market soared 75%. We've had an uptick this week, but it's been down and down since Obama took office.
Well, it has, and I think the banking piece is the largest reason why. In looking back, what was it now? 3 weeks ago, the Secretary Geithner, maybe a month ago, made his speech, and really he said, "I'll be back to you on this, on the details." Mm. Well, that was not well thought through. And from what I've been reading, they were ready to say A, and suddenly Geithner said, no, we need to do B, and that they just weren't able to get together whatever their plan was. And every day that goes by without having that plan out there, I think confidence seeps away. Now, of course, when the plan comes out there, that also is going to create all kinds of issues. I mean, is there going to be a kind of creeping nationalization? Will these assets that are out there be overvalued by the government? Will there be bad banks and good banks? In other words, they're putting something off, and it looks like it's hurting them, but wait till they come out with the real plan. Then we'll really see some of the objections.
Let's get a flavor of some of the criticism and the pushback. Here is billionaire business mogul Warren Buffett, who's been very friendly to Democrats, but here he is at a three-hour CNBC interview, Obama supporter, but also lodged criticism at President Obama's handling of the economic crisis.
Republicans have an obligation to regard this as an economic war and to realize you need one leader and in general support of that. But I think that the Democrats, and I voted for Obama and I strongly support him and I think he's the right guy. But I think when they're calling for unity on a question this important, they should not use it to roll the Republicans all. I think a lot of things should be. Job one is to win the war, the economic war. Job two is to win the economic war, and job three. And you can't expect people to unite behind you if you're trying to jam a whole bunch of things down their throats.
Warren Buffett on CNBC. Of course, they've taken guff from Jon Stewart for a week and more now, but that's another story. Jonathan Kaufman, how about it? Part of the complaint here is, and President Obama responded to it yesterday, you are trying to do too much at one time, sir. Warren Buffett kind of picking that up here.
No, I think he is, and I think that's one of the things that, you know, presidents often fall into. Remember, George W. Bush fell into this as well. Thought he was elected with a mandate and tried to jam through a whole bunch of things in both foreign policy and domestic policy, and it turned out it came back to be his undoing. I think the Obama people and Obama himself are very ambitious, but they need to focus on the economy, in part because this criticism is not just coming from the U.S. It's not just congressmen or voters. The Prime Minister of China just yesterday said that he was worried about the safety of U.S. Treasuries.
He who is our banker.
Exactly. This is like your banker calling you up saying, I'm worried about your mortgage payments.
Or more like him saying it on a megaphone in the street.
Exactly. And so I think that you know, Obama really has to focus his attention. And I think people understand that there are a lot of these issues are related together. But there is a feeling that one of the things that undid presidents like Jimmy Carter was that they tried to do too much.
On the other hand, who has faced a raft of issues like this at one time? Obama, President Obama makes the case, you can't really undo what we have fallen into over many years unless you address this whole waterfront. Let's hear a little bit of that. Here he was yesterday at the Business Roundtable rejecting the criticism that he's taken on too many projects in the face of the economic woe.
I'm not choosing to address these additional challenges just because I feel like it or because I'm a glutton for punishment. I'm doing so because they're fundamental to our economic growth and ensuring that we don't have more crises like this in the future. You see, we cannot go back to endless cycles of bubble and bust. We can't continue to base our economy on reckless speculation and spending beyond our means, on bad credit and inflated home prices and over-leveraged banks. This crisis teaches us that such activity is not the creation of lasting wealth, it's the illusion of prosperity, and it hurts us all in the end.
Jack Beatty, there's the president saying, come on, we all know this isn't something that, one pitch, one fastball is going to cure. How about it?
Well, yes. I mean, he's been in office 50 days, and these are, you know, John Maynard Keynes really is the poet of our moment, and he says all this is about animal spirits. And, of course, the animal spirits of investors are low, and they're not going to rise unless something happens in the real world. Now, the president, if you compare what we're doing to our crisis vis-a-vis what Europe is doing, and this is going to come up this weekend in the meeting in London, we're stepping up to it, it looks like. I mean, by a considerable considerable fraction. Our stimulus package is bigger than anything the Europeans are offering, not as big as China. And we're trying to get them to take it seriously as we seem to be doing. So, I mean, if we're comparing apples and apples, we're taking it a heck of a lot more seriously than the Europeans. But I do think this question of the banks and getting that right is just going to continue to haunt this administration. You know, there are reports that Robert Rubin has been offering advice, and in fact, this has been confirmed in places.
Former Treasury Secretary High in Citibank.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is a man who collected $100 million while his company basically nearly disappeared, became a ward of government, and he's been giving advice about what to do about these troubled assets and so on. This really bothers me. This is the old order. These people are discredited, and I hate to think that the administration is building in a sort of let's see what Bob Rubin thinks plank to this jerry-built plan.
Andrea, we're going to dig in with you on Congress. Let me get one call right here. Paul in Salem, Massachusetts. Paul, quickly before the break, you're on the air, sir.
Yes, great. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
The bickering on either side of the aisle is getting very boring. Obviously, the old way of doing things has not worked. President Obama is one of the finest presidents since FDR or Kennedy or any of our presidents that have tried to do a job that is very difficult. This president is not acting as a figurehead.
So what, you're saying you're confident? Give him time?
Yes, of course. Leave him alone. And the bipartisanship is not going to happen as long as they are arguing and fighting across the aisles.
Let us pick that up. Andrew, we've just got a few seconds before the break. But one of the features here is this is not just Republicans going at President Obama. He's got Democrats expressing concern, too.
He does. And I think these have all been such really good points. I think part of the problem here is that you've got these people who are hurting bad, especially Wall Street, and they're screaming, fix it now, fix it now, fix it now. And what Obama, the case he's trying to make is that we need to do a bigger structural change in order to fix it for the long term. And so you have to ask yourself, and the voters out there have to ask themselves, who is he representing here?
I mean, Andrea, hold that thought. We'll come back and look at just that question. And we'll turn to Bernie Madoff. You know where he is. The Soggy Bottom Boys here from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? We're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Stop playing cards and a shooting dice. He's in the jailhouse now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Obama's team in the hot seat on the economy, earmarks over Washington, and Bernie Madoff goes directly to jail. Jonathan Kaufman of the Wall Street Journal is here. Andrea Seabrook is here, NPR's congressional correspondent, and Jack Beatty. Andrea, you were saying the question is, who is President Obama fighting for? What are you hearing on Capitol Hill about that?
Well, I think I think for the last, at least decade, 15 years, the economists in this country, the Alan Greenspans, have been raised to sort of saint status. I mean, they have been gods among men and have told us how we will run our country, how we will run our economy.
The markets went up and up.
And I think the case that Obama is ultimately trying to make in the fundamental level is that if he sits back here and listens only to the economists, then what is going to happen is we will put a quick fix, we will make the markets go up and up again, but we won't solve the fundamental problems that underlie mm-hmm. the crash that is going on now. And so he can't just sit around and he can't just sit and listen only to, the people who are screaming about make it better now. He has, in his mind anyway, he has to fix those things like the healthcare system, which is a big part of why things are going all cockeyed here. Yeah. The cost of healthcare. And so ultimately, what I'm saying is that he is representing the interests of a broader spectrum of the country, not just the economists in this case. And I think that's the case he's trying to make.
Timothy Geithner making that case yesterday before the Senate Budget Committee, saying President Obama's priorities will bring back the economy for the long term.
We'll have different priorities, different judgments about what's going to get the economy growing again, but there's very few economists who would not agree that addressing the growth in healthcare costs improving educational outcomes, improving our infrastructure, and moving us to a cleaner energy economy are not absolutely necessary conditions for improving long-term growth potential of this economy.
There's Timothy Geithner yesterday. Let's hear from Eric in Barrington, Rhode Island. Eric, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, how are you?
All right.
You know, from my perspective, I guess, you know, I was a big Obama supporter. I still am. But I get worried about the idea of just the hubris of humans and all of this. It kind of reminds me of these massive civil engineering projects that, you know, all the geniuses put together to redirect a river or something like that, and they do it all right, and then some big storm comes along and washes the whole thing away. And I'm wondering if we're kind of doing the same thing with the economy. You know, there's that age-old debate of free market versus managed economy, and are we just sort of being, you know, fooling ourselves once again?
But what about the hubris of free market ideology that thought the market would take care of everything? And look where we are, Eric.
Well, I mean, that's the question, isn't it? But once we've sort of started down the road of letting Bear Stearns fail but not Citigroup, then we sort of are stuck in the middle. And it seems like we're just not looking at things in the right perspective,
yeah,
or something like that.
Jack Beatty, Eric puts us right on the pivot point here, doesn't he? I mean, whether or not there's confidence that we can do these things, as we were told for decades, the market would take care of. They were beyond the capacity of any group of brains, and now some group of brains has to get in there and do something.
Yes, and you know, so long as it's the market, well, I mean, there's no one to blame. There's no one to hold responsible. It's just this miracle, this thing that happens off stage. But now it's decision makers in Washington. We're not saying to the market, you know, perform better. We're saying to Timothy Geithner, have your plan correspond to things in reality that will change reality. Well, that's a heck of a lot to ask, and I think that, you know, Eric's worry, I understand his worry. If they were trying to, you know, create some structure that was going to be an alternative to what we have, they're just trying to get the system we have to work. And they're dealing with the overwhelming fact that there's going to be a $2 trillion shortfall in economic activity over the next 2 years, and that desperately the government has got to try to fill that, either through stimulus or through loosening the bank, the credit crisis, or printing more, whatever it takes. They've got to deal with that, and it can make it seem as if they're trying to fine-tune it. Actually, they're not. They just want this thing to start, the arrows to start pointing up.
I promise we're going to get to Bernard Madoff here, but Jonathan Kaufman with the Wall Street Journal, here you are. The Journal had a survey of economists on how is the president doing. You know, we've got callers and others saying, let's get beyond the economists. They blew it, but their score wasn't good that they gave the White
House. Right, exactly. What was so striking is that, you know, before Obama took office, economists in general were very impressed with him. They thought his policies made sense. He had, say, a 50 or a 60% approval rating among professional economists. Now, economists are giving him low grades. 42% of the economists we spoke to are giving him a grade of 60, which, as we know from high school and college, is not a good grade at all.
But should we care? Economists also, many said we were doing pretty well here, and now we're at the bottom of the cliff.
Well, I think this is exactly the kind of problem that Jack was talking about, which is that nobody really has an answer. It feels like everything is a bit of a Hail Mary pass right now. And I think that is what erodes people's confidence, is if you begin to think that no one really knows what to do, then people start losing confidence in the ability of government to do anything. That's why, in a sense, it's almost a political issue as much as an economic one. How do you restore confidence? How do you get people to give you more time to figure this out? Right now, you have economists disagreeing with bankers, bankers disagreeing with union people disagreeing with their own memberships in some case. And that sense of kind of panic, I think, begins to creep into how people look at this.
We're not finished with the Obama economic policy or how Congress is taking that on board. But the morality play that stood shadowing everything this week was Bernard Madoff in New York, in the courtroom, out of his penthouse, and in jail. 7x8 cell or something like that. I want to ask my guests what they think of it, but let's hear straight from listeners first in Los Angeles, California. Saad is calling. Saad, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tal. I have a comment about Madoff. I think he's such a rare phenomenon. This guy is a financial savvy. If I were the prosecutor, I probably will make a deal with him. You've got 12 months to design a plan to solve the country's financial crisis. Or else you will be in jail.
Oh, well.
Hey, we're looking for a messiah, and his name is Bernie Madoff. But wait a minute, Saad. Oh, he's financially savvy. He just used, you know, my money to pay you, or your money to pay me, didn't he?
Well, but that's not going to solve. That's not going to give the people their money back, basically.
No. Maybe we could just use China's money.
The same intelligence that was used in a negative way, maybe we can harness it to use it in a positive way. You wouldn't put Einstein in jail if he committed a crime.
Bernard Madoff for chairman of the SEC. I don't know. We'll have to chew on that, Saad, but thank you for your call. David in Arlington, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't know that I would want Bernie Madoff running anything right now, but my comment is...
Not to worry.
I think that he is a symptom more than the central problem. He's a thief, and there's always thieves, but the lack of confidence that needs to be addressed to turn this around, I think, stems from our own government. Don't you think there are other people that were supposed to be working for the government that should at least be under investigation after this debacle that let this man literally run unchecked for 12 years?
If you want to know my personal opinion, yes, I do. Andrea Seabrook, how about it? Is there talk in Washington about anybody else paying the piper here?
No, there is certainly talk. There's all kinds of chatter in the hallways about who's going to go down next, who they're going to look at, who at the SEC needs to have gotten these calls before the actual end.
But do you mean like handcuffs, courtroom kind of thing, or just fired, or I don't know what?
I can't speculate on what could happen there, but there are people who are mad, and I think it stems actually from a similar problem, and that is that, again, the economists, the big players, the Wall Street has been full of gods among men in this country for the last 10 or 15 years. Unquestionable. What they're doing is making our country work, making things better, creating wealth for everyone, right?
Well, we thought so.
So we thought so. And so people like Bernie Madoff were able to just, you know, skim along with this giant scheme for so long because nobody really asked the tough questions of these people. The oversight has been lax. And I think that is what's making members of Congress extremely angry about this whole situation.
Jack Beatty, I mean, at least Bernard Madoff is out of the penthouse and he's in a jail cell. There are how many million Americans in jail cells for how much less than his offenses? But what is the more important moral bottom line here? Or I don't know. How do you look at the story, Jack?
Well, there is the point that Andrea is making, the regulatory point. We've discovered that in the Bush years, and I don't lay this all on Bush, but that in the Bush years, the SEC lawyers would come up with a case, they'd want to make a case against somebody, and the SEC board, which was full of people who thought, oh, let the market work without any human... Well, I think that's what Obama is saying. That was part of the illusion. Right? I mean, we had a system that was not regulated. And thanks to, you know, laws passed in the Clinton administration, these derivatives and these complicated mortgage packages weren't even regulated. They were, by law, off everybody's radar screen. And you know, that's a scandal. That's a scandal of our system. It's the way in which capitalism really overwhelms itself. Capitalism without government turns into theft very, very easily. And desperately, we needed regulation and law. And Obama is saying, you know, if we can't afford this illusory prosperity, let's have regulated and transparent prosperity.
He's going to jail, maybe prison for life. How much we'll ever learn about where that money went is still an open question. Here's one attorney, Jeffrey Servin, attended the Madoff hearing on behalf of some clients outside the courthouse. He said it's difficult to know the extent of Madoff's fraud.
Somebody who's been able to do something like this for this long a period of time in this much detail, I probably thought the downside of it through very well, too. Do I think there's money somewhere hidden? Yeah. Are we ever going to find it? Who knows?
Kevin in Tynmouth, Vermont. You're on the air, Kevin.
Hey, how you doing today?
We're all right. What do you think about Bernard Madoff, sir?
Oh, I think what he did was insanely wrong. But at the same time, you know, we're going to put him in jail that we have to pay for again. He's got our money. and now we're paying for him to be in jail. I'd say we should put him out in the public in a little rinky-dink apartment, get rid of all his assets, bring that back to us, whatever he might have, and then that way he has to work a little job. He can't make any more than anything, and he's still paying restitution.
Hey, I'm hearing that. Store 24 for Bernie Madoff, Jonathan Kaufman. What about this whole story? And thanks, Kevin.
Well, one of the things I think is so interesting is that at the Madoff hearing, it wasn't just CNBC and the Wall Street Journal mm-hmm. covering it. It was Extra and Entertainment Tonight. And even TMZ, which is a celebrity news show, has been reporting on the excesses of bankers having these big rock concerts.
What does that tell
money.
You?
I think what that says
you mean
is
bringing
is
in Rod Stewart for the birthday party and
yeah,
all that jazz.
There is this populist anger against Madoff. And against the bankers, and more broadly against these excesses that we've seen. And I think that's a very powerful force that politically could be harnessed or could become very dangerous. But the idea of stalking bankers the way we stalk celebrities suggests that there is an appetite, there's sort of an anger that people want to express. Mm-hmm. They want to target. And I think Madoff, in a sense, is one rotten apple. But I'm surprised in a way that there hasn't been more anger directed against the bankers behind this. We really haven't had the kind of, you know, back in the previous financial scandals, there's always sort of one rotten apple that mm-hmm, sticks out. Mm-hmm. But you really haven't seen, like Jack Beatty talks about, Bob Rubin or some of the big Wall Street figures, really pilloried in a way. And I wonder if that's going to happen at some point, because people want to find somebody to blame.
Maybe at the G20 this weekend in Europe we'll hear that. Oh, maybe anger still turns into policy. But I'm not sure the country's resolved its sense of what the fundamental sort of compass setting ought to be here yet, in spite of everything. Let's go to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and Sherry. Sherry, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm a financial economist.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing, Sherry?
I think it. I'm well-trained. I've taught
okay.
for years and years.
Good.
I think I know what I'm talking about,
mm-hmm.
and the people on your panel, I'm afraid, do not.
So economists like you advised us for the last how many years, and here we are. I mean,
economists what?
Economists,
yes.
well-trained, advised us for a long
sir.
Time,
just,
and here we are in a mess. So but anyway, I'm sorry, I'm too cheeky. What's your point?
The source of the mess,
mm-hmm.
the market was yes, there are thieves out there. Yes, there are people who take money from one person and give it to another illegally. Mm-hmm. But that's fundamentally what the government is doing. They are taking money from one group of people and putting it where they think it needs to go in order primarily to get votes. The market...
Well, what about to right the economy, to balance our society?
No, sir. Mm-hmm. What is wrong with the economy, what is happening right this minute, is a lack of confidence in where we're going from here. It is worry about the government interfering in the private business of mom-and-pop businesses up the street. Your people you go to get a haircut from, people you go to buy a car from, going to the local bank to get a loan to do business. It was regulations that were designed to put mortgages in the hands of high-risk individuals, not just low-income, but our neighbors who got a second mortgage in order to take a vacation.
Sure, we've got it. That's a piece of it, but we all know now that's not all of it. Jonathan Kaufman, Financial Times, the Financial Times big headline now, says, you know, was capitalism overrated? I mean, Sherry's still solidly on board, and many people are with the market, but you've got people who know a lot about markets who are looking at what just happened here and saying, wait a minute, we've got to take some big lesson away.
No, I think clearly there is a pivot point, and we're clearly moving into a time of greater regulation. I think that's the broader theme when we look back. And the next few years, you'll see more regulation of financial markets. You'll see more regulation of money flows, of mortgages, sort of all across the board.
But we've been told for years that was, you know, the road to no growth, and Sherry articulates that view very well, and it's not gone.
But one of the things that's interesting, and this is sort of a little bit wonky, but a lot of people in the Obama administration have been following a sort of new theory of economics. And this theory of economics is very much reality-based, and it's based on the idea that we now have actually a lot of information out there on behavioral economics. We see how people respond to economic incentives. And one of the things that they're concluding, and these are concerns conservatives mm-hmm. as well as liberals, is that no regulation is a problem and people behave badly, as we've seen. Mm-hmm. And by putting in more regulation, you can actually put up guardrails that can have growth, but have regulated growth that doesn't have these excesses.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tibet in the news. More foreclosure auctions, and John Stewart faces off with CNBC's Jim Cramer this week. 50 years after the failed uprising that left him in exile, the Dalai Lama said that China is deliberately provoking Tibetans.
I think the local Chinese authority want more crisis so that they can crush easily.
Warnings of a new wave of foreclosures. Here's an auction in New York.
Number 223 in Maplewood. Let's go. 39,000.
39,000. 39,000 to buy now. 40, 50, now 50, now 60, now 70, now 80. I'm bid 20,000 to buy. Put him in 80,000 to buy now.
And on we go. And John Stewart has been taking on CNBC's Jim Cramer to task for not giving Americans better advice about the economy. The two squared off last night face to face on The Daily Show.
Why do I have banana cream pies? Because I throw them at CEOs. Do you know how many times I have pants CEOs
but
on my show?
But this isn't, as Carly Simon would say, this song ain't about you.
Okay. All right. You're right.
I bet you think this song is about you. We're looking at a week in the news. Andrea Seabrook of NPR in Washington joins us. Jonathan Kaufman of The Wall Street Journal. Jack Beatty's here. Let's go to Buffalo, New York. And Jay, hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom and Jack.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'd like to make a comment about, I would like to see someone take a look at how the senators, our congressmen, aided and abetted this financial crisis. And I say this because it was only 2 years ago that Senator Schumer and Michael Bloomberg came out with a study talking about New York City losing ground as the financial capital of the world. And the companies that they all interviewed for this were mm-hmm. AIG, Citigroup, Washington Mutual, Wachovia. And these talked about mm-hmm. leveraging and credit derivative obligations. This man took campaign obligations and was a water boy for this financial industry, and yet he's not accountable for it.
Andrea, what do you say?
Well, there's a point that I wanted to make, and that is that the Bernie Madoff scandal is not actually separate, I think, politically from the stimulus and the bailout and all of these things. Because I think, the Obama and a lot of these members of Congress here in the Capitol feel like they are speaking to all of these things at once when they're asking for greater regulation. And I think that the reason why TMZ and the celebrity talk shows and all this are following Bernie Madoff's trial is because his trial has plucked a nerve in the national consciousness, this sense that the fat cats on Wall Street are, getting our money, as one of the callers said, our money. Mm-hmm. And that, that's the reason why the economy is tanking. And I think what you're seeing is this overall sense that this is only going to be solved when the people like the Madoffs aren't able to actually pull off schemes like this. And so,
but it's not straight-up criminals that are the only issue here. I mean, we're looking at what the right balance in our entire economic system is, Jack.
Well, yeah, and we're also looking, I think Jay raises a crucial point, at government by campaign contribution, which mm-hmm. is essentially the government we have. Now, Obama says he wants to change that, and he will try to change that. But just look at the flow of the news. We hear congressman and senator after senator who has some little part in this. Chris Dodd with his friendly mortgage from Countrywide. Mm-hmm. Again and again, things come out about individual members. And if you go back and start to look at who's been paying for Congress, who especially in recent years has been paying for the Democratic Party, I regret to say, it is increasingly Wall Street. And they have been getting what they paid for.
Andrea?
There's something very interesting that's been going on for the last couple of weeks here in the Capitol. Congressman Jeff Flake of Arizona, Republican who is Mr. Anti-Earmark here in the Capitol, has been introducing this privileged resolution over and over and over again that would force members of Congress not just to it started out as stripping earmarks. It's become stripping earmarks that give what he calls no-bid contracts to private companies. In other words, special projects that go specifically to private companies, specific private companies. He's saying that there's no difference between a congressional earmark like that and giving out a no-bid contract from the Pentagon to a specific company. And he's
and
gaining
these,
traction.
He's afraid that people have received contributions from the people in the same companies they're then giving straight-up business to no-bid.
He's not just afraid. He has a list of members of Congress who are getting huge campaign contributions from specific companies that then the Congress turns around and passes a bill with an earmark in it that gives business to that company, that specific company, not just, you know, a contract to some company that can do it, but to specifically that company. And so this has happened time and time again, both in the Republican and the Democratic Party. And it is a huge problem that people are starting. He's starting to gain some actual traction among both Democrats and Republicans.
We've had Jeff Flake on, Republican. We hope to have him on again soon. I want to come to earmarks, but we've got listeners who have things to say here. Detroit, Michigan, Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm just listening, and I hear it everywhere. It just seems like everyone's saying there's no regulations, but I think everyone knows that there have been regulations on the books for years, and they add more every year.
But enough and the right ones and enforced properly? I mean, what does Madoff say about that, Joe?
Enforced taxation is enforced. Maybe we should look at the root of government in general. If it's not voluntary, can it be good? If someone has a gun to your head saying, I'll protect your business, you just got to pay up, and you pay up your whole life and never have violence to come to you, does that still make it right?
But you know, we came together to make a country on this continent, not just a Wild West.
100 years ago with a contract that is not being fulfilled. I never said, legally, I think any lawyer would say, if you didn't sign the contract, how is it a contract?
Everything's on the table. We hear it, Joe. Let's go to Richard in Brookline, Massachusetts. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to sort of open the record on economists, because there are financial economists that are focused really on Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
And just as the previous caller said, regulation, in fact, didn't keep getting added. After World War II, everybody pretty much was distrustful of markets, and lots of regulation was added. By the time we hit the 70s, regulations were being steadily dismantled. Still, in the late 80s, early 90s, the whole world got around to imposing risk-adjusted capital requirements on banks, only to find that the end of the decade, Glass-Steagall was eliminated, and so companies that were not under those restrictions got into the banking business. And it comes into what economists understand as externalities. The participants were rewarded handsomely for taking excessive risks. The consequences of those risks were not incurred by those individuals. Indeed, they were long gone with their bonuses by the time the thing fell apart.
Richard, it sounds like you're speaking as an economist yourself, and you're saying there was a vacuum on the regulation side.
I'm sorry?
You're saying then there was, in fact, a vacuum, effectively, on the regulation
side.
Absolutely.
And economists have understood for decades that if you leave a vacuum when there is the possibility of externalities, there will sooner or later be abuses and excessive costs requiring additional regulation.
Are you speaking as an economist, Richard?
Yes.
If we come into a period where regulation then is revved up a bit again to try and get a handle on this, do you see that as cramping economic growth, as undergirding economic growth?
Well, there's something to be said for its cramping growth, but the growth that it cramps turned out to be ephemeral.
Yeah, no kidding. Richard, thank you very much for your call. Our clock is starting to go on us, and we haven't come to the earmarks business yet, and I want to talk about that because Jeff Flake brings up earmarks. The president talks about earmarks. Andrew Seabrook, in the campaign, Barack Obama was very clear again and again saying, I want to get earmarks out of these budgets, and yet We saw a whole lot of many billions approved this week with thousands of earmarks in it. Now, you know, he said, I won't keep doing that. But is that fulfilling campaign promises or not?
Well, you know, you saw this political dance this week saying this omnibus bill, this bill that would take us through the end of the fiscal year, is last year's business. It's not business now. This is last year's business. So we can just pass it with 9,000 earmarks in it, and it's no big deal. You know, I think everybody smelled that one. That one was ugly, and I think they paid for it, and they will keep paying for it. At the same time, the Republicans were hammering on the Democrats for this, and rightly so. And at the same time, the Democrats only had to put out one press release, the one that was titled, "You Can't Spell Earmark Without an R." And,
i.e. Republicans do it too.
Exactly. And the Republicans had this blush across their faces and had to be quiet about it. They had 40% of the earmarks in this bill as well. So I think several of the callers have very astutely pointed out that this is a structural problem, as an economist might say, an endemic problem, one that is a big problem within the system. And I think the Obama administration has an uphill fight with members of his party, with members of the other party, to actually do this. I mean, you're even hearing his own people, Obama's own people, talking about cutting earmarks in half by, you know, 10 years from
2025.
Yeah, right, exactly. Right. I mean, this is not ending earmarks.
Which is what we heard in the campaign. Republicans may have been ultimately quiet, I don't know, but not entirely. Here's House Minority Leader John Boehner saying President Obama was wrong to sign the omnibus spending bill.
I think the president missed a golden opportunity today to really fulfill his campaign commitment to not sign bills that have a lot of wasteful spending and are overburdened with earmarks.
Jack, what did you expect from the president on this front?
Just what he did. I mean, if he had done this, he would have thrown this whole budget open for negotiation, and they were, in fact, up against a 24- or 48-hour deadline, which might have resulted in the government being shut down. Look, he doesn't need any more problems by bringing it on with this. And we have to regard the substance and not the form. The substance, this is 2% of the bill. Now, everybody makes a lot about Beatles and the like. Well, you know, I watched Senator Bennett from Utah going at John McCain. He says, you know, you may be criticizing us about these Mormon Beatles, but they're hell on our crops out here. We got to find out what's going on with these suckers. The point is, not all of these things are what we would regard as, you know, total waste. And if the idea is, let's have them be transparent, let's have the Congress debate each bill. Do you really want Congress debating $1 million to investigate Mormon Beatles?
Mormon Beatles. What next? Let's get a call from Michael in Sandwich, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to make a comment about Jon Stewart, if I could.
The Daily Show comedian and news commentator.
Well, that's my point, I guess. I mean, his performance last night was just absolutely brilliant. And
this is going after
Jim Cramer.
Cramer of CNBC, who he's gone at for a week now, just unbelievably, very effectively.
Yeah, but last night, for the night, he wasn't even a comedian. He was more of a journalist, and he just did a brilliant job. He had his facts straight. He had his ideas straight. Mm-hmm. He wasn't afraid to confront the guy. And as I was watching it and thinking about it, it occurred to me that how sad it is that it takes a comedian to show the journalist community how to do it, because he really did a fantastic job, and we just don't have enough of these hard questions being asked of everybody, government officials, business leaders, other journalists.
I could not agree more, Michael. Could not agree more. Jonathan Coffin, Wall Street Journal. He wasn't taking on your outfit. He was taking on CNBC. But you could say by extension, he was saying, why hasn't this been so plainly pointed out by the rest of the media? How, you know, financial commentators and reporters were sort of not asking half the questions that ought to be asked or saying the opposite of what turned out to be true.
Well, I think it's part of a broader phenomenon, and that you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. And then when you're on the boat, you're feeling pretty good that you're rising and rising. Mm-hmm. I don't think journalists can be singled out. I think all of us as private citizens kept on opening up our 401ks or our stock portfolios and thinking what great investors we were.
But they're not supposed to be entirely on the boat or on the yacht, on Bernie Madoff's yacht.
I think at the Wall Street Journal and other places, certainly certainly we can all point to investigations we did, prizes that we won that showed all the flaws in the system. But I think we all, as a country, did fall into what Jack and Andrea have talked about, was this general sense that we bought the story. We bought the story that, in fact, liberalism was over, Reagan had been right, deregulation was a good thing, and the proof was that there was all this money sloshing around. And so I think the reckoning that came to us as a country has also come to journalists as well, in that in the same way we perhaps weren't as skeptical about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, we weren't as skeptical about what was going on. And part of that is because, you know, everyone you spoke to, with the exception of really only a very few people, Joe Stiglitz, Paul Krugman, and others, well-respected, you know, we're saying that, you know, things will be fine.
Party
things
on.
Will be fine. Exactly. And so I think there is a lesson that we've learned from that. But again, you know, we were talking to lots of people and everybody was enjoying the party.
I've got to take a point of privilege here and spin the globe just a little bit. China, very much in the news. You mentioned Wen Jiabao, Chinese premier, saying he's worried about all the Chinese cash that's in U.S. treasuries and all the rest. Also, those five Chinese ships that were bumping up against the American, the Impeccable was the American ship, unarmed in the South China Sea. We've only got a minute or so here, John. But what's going on? First of all, why would they challenge a U.S. Navy ship? And is China still on board here or something?
Well, I lived in China for 3 years covering China for the Wall Street Journal. And one of the things you see that the Chinese are very good at doing is that famous Maoist dictum, when our opponents retreat, we attack. When our opponents attack, we retreat. China, like the rest of the world, sees that the U.S. is very preoccupied right now. It's in a somewhat weakened state because of Iraq, because of the financial crisis. And the pattern of the Chinese, I think, over and over again, is to push things. In other words, if they see a situation where they can get a small advantage, where the U.S. is preoccupied in Iraq, you saw the Chinese moving in a huge way in Africa, dominating African economies, really setting up a beachhead. Now suddenly the U.S. is preoccupied internally with its economic situation, so China starts flexing its military muscles, sort of pushing our naval intelligence ships a little bit further away. I think it's part of this endless game that they play, which is wherever they see a chance to gain an advantage, they'll gain it. And we have to be careful as a country to think that just because we're preoccupied with the economy, others aren't looking at ways to gain advantage militarily or in foreign policy ways during this time.
Ladies and gentlemen, watch this space. Jonathan Kaufman with The Wall Street Journal, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Andrea Seabrook of NPR in Washington. Andrea, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Jack Beatty, have a great weekend, my friend.
Thank you.
Listeners, we have a great team here at On Point of producers. They do amazing work week in and week out. Right in the middle of that team for years now has been our beloved Tanya Raleigh. She heads off today to a new chapter, and we wish her the very best with that. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby, with help from Kathy Corman and Sam Sanders. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.